All right, so I was asked to speak on one of my favorite topics. The official title is God and Science, Enemies or Friends, something like that, yes? Okay, that's a good name for the topic. So I'm going to kind of do a talk on a scientist's view of why it's reasonable to believe in God. And actually, it's going to be two parts. The first part will be a God and Science, and then the second part will be science in the Bible. So in 45 minutes, I have to cover God and science in the Bible. That's going to be pretty quick, but we'll see. All right, so I'm going to have us consider two possible explanations of reality. I've already said that the atheist or the naturalist explanation of reality doesn't work, and it doesn't work on many levels. And I'd say it's almost certainly not true. In fact, I'd say it's definitely not true. But here's Thomas Huxley. Thomas Huxley was a good friend of Charles Darwin. He was sometimes called Darwin's bulldog. Because Darwin, he was a fairly humble guy, by the way. Darwin, everything I know about Darwin tells me he was actually a pretty good guy. He's a fairly nice guy, actually. And Thomas Huxley was the one who kind of went out and defended his theory. He said, "We are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth or the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." That's the atheistic explanation. So molecule A bumped into molecule B, made more complex molecule C, which bumped into molecule D, making ever more complex molecule E, F, G, and H, and I. And next thing you know, life just sort of pops out. And then some, you know, random mutations happen, and then here we are. And people take that seriously. In fact, a lot of scientists, they just laugh at Christianity as like a bunch of ignorant people who are looking for a crutch. By the way, if somebody ever accused you of looking for a crutch, say, "Amen." That's right. I need a crutch. I'm a sinner. And then there's Richard Dawkins, a more modern version. Said, "In the universe of blind physical force and genetic replication, some are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find rhyme or reason or any justice." No justice. So why even have a court system then? "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA that neither knows nor cares, it just is, and we dance to its music." Well, if that's true, then I guess we have to accept it. It's a pretty tough truth. That's kind of depressing. I wonder why Richard doesn't just end it all. All right, I'm going to present another view, which I think is much more rational. And the idea of design. William Paley used the watchmaker argument, but I don't know. I kind of like the cell phone argument. It's a little bit more up to date. So let's imagine you're walking down the street and you see a pocket watch. No, a cell phone. Thinking, man, how'd that get there? I don't know. You know, there's some metal and some, you know, plastic and, you know, and some cars ran over it in the rain. People kicked it around and cell phone. What do you think? Now that would be irrational. In fact, anybody who believed that, we would know right away, has some serious logic issues. Now, which is more complex? Which has more moving parts? Which has a greater design level, a bacteria or a cell phone? I'll tell you right now, the bacteria is much more complex and has much more evidence, if you will, of design than the cell phone. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. But there's people that believe, they actually believe, that a bacteria could just pop into existence by random accident. And they'll look you in the face and they'll tell you it's true. And they'll say, if you don't agree with them, then you're crazy. Okay, I'd say a better thing would be like this. Let's imagine you've got a junkyard. And there's a tornado comes through there, and there's dirt and plastic and mud and
glass, and boom, out pops a 747. A singular series of beneficial accidents. No rhyme, no reason, no purpose. Blind, pitiless indifference. And the thing is, I think a lot of us believers, we're intimidated by these atheist people. As if, you know, when they laugh at us for being so ignorant to believe that maybe the Bible might be true, that maybe they have a point, you know. We don't actually believe that, but in our heart, we act almost like we're... If you're intimidated by something like that, I don't know. I don't think you should be. One of the lessons, take-home lessons from this is don't be afraid of smart-looking bald people with glasses. Okay, don't be intimidated by those people. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to spend about 20 minutes giving some examples of things that I give in my introductory chemistry and physics classes that to me scream out design. All right? So there's the water molecule. What an amazing design. All right, there you go. You got your, in case you didn't know, H-O-H, I got, in case you didn't know, I got that up there so you'll know, H-O-2-O, that's water. All right, and you could teach an entire one semester course explaining the unique properties that water has, why it has those properties. And every single one of those properties that water has, if water didn't have that property, we wouldn't be here. And some people think it's just an accident. I'm saying, well, that's a pretty big accident. Okay, for example, water is bent. It's bent at about 109 degrees. The exact angle doesn't really matter. And I'm telling you, lucky for us that water is bent. Because if it was not bent, instead of boiling at about 100 degrees, it would boil around minus 150 degrees. And in which case, you know, we'd all vaporize instantaneously, but there'd be no life. So one of the properties then is this boiling point, because in order for life to exist, it has to be a liquid. A gas cannot be the basis for life, and certainly a solid can. It has to be a liquid. And only a few substances are liquid, by the way, within a certain range, because according to science, above about 80 degrees centigrade, below about minus 30 degrees centigrade, life literally cannot exist. Not in the universe that we live in, because below that temperature, there's not enough energy for chemical reactions to happen. On any level that could support life at all. And above maybe 80 degrees centigrade, the molecules that are these sensitive and delicate molecules fall apart. And water happens to be liquid almost across the entire range, but lucky for us, not the whole range, and there's a reason for that. Okay, so water has the right boiling and melting point in order to sustain life. It's important that that solvent for life has three phases, if you will, all within a fairly narrow range, which water does. Another thing about water is its solvent properties. In order for life to exist, this liquid that supports life has to be able to dissolve a wide variety of molecules. And water, by the way, dissolves a wider variety of molecules than any other liquid. In fact, the liquid that's going to support life has to dissolve ions. Because without ions, there couldn't possibly be life. And I don't care how you describe it or think about it, create a model. Without ions, we certainly wouldn't have a nervous system. And guess how many liquids dissolve ions? There's millions of liquids. Guess how many of them dissolve ions? Only one, and that's water. It's the only liquid that dissolves ions. Another property that water has is it absorbs a lot of heat. Water absorbs 10 times more heat than most substances, and 3 or 4 times more heat than virtually all substances. And of all the substances in the universe, it absorbs the most heat by far. It's not even close. The next competitor is less than half. Okay, well, maybe that's an accident. But if water didn't absorb so much heat, then the temperature of the Earth would go up and down by 200 or 300 degrees centigrade in any given year, and again, no life. Now, I used to live in Wisconsin. The people in Wisconsin are amazing because they can walk on water in the winter. All right. Now, most substances have the property that the solid sinks and the liquid floats. Why? Because generally when things are colder, they're more dense. When they're warmer, they're less dense. Guess how many compounds out of the tens of millions of compounds that have been either made or found, of those millions, guess how many have the solid floating on the liquid? Exactly one. Only one, and that's water. Why is that important? Well, first of all, you have to understand it's important that this liquid that supports life has a solid phase. Because what happens is, in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. Now, water has this other really weird property. I need to put a graph up. I don't know if you're going to get it, but I'll just try. All other substances, if you graph density versus temperature, it goes like this. The one exception? Water. It goes like this, and at 4 degrees centigrade, it goes like that, and then it drops like that and becomes ice. Which, of course, other things go up like that. And again, essential, because in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the lighter, colder water, which floats on top of the heavier, warmer water. Otherwise, the lakes would freeze to the bottom in the winter. Okay, Florida, we don't care about that so much. But during ice ages, the oceans would have frozen to the bottom and life would have been eliminated. Nice plan. And I could talk about the viscosity of water. I could talk about the surface tension of water. Every property that water has, every single one, is amazing and unique. And every single one, if water didn't have that property, wouldn't be here. And some people say, we're just lucky. I say, that's pretty lucky. All right. Now, some of you are probably starting to get hives right now and, Doug Deem and I, we were talking about this. He was saying, he said, did you know that there's so many interesting things about the periodic chart? I said, well, Doug, yeah, I know that. All right. Now, I tell my chemistry students that that Mendeleev invented this chart, okay? But I'm telling you right now, God's fingerprints are all over this chart. There are at least 22 elements that I know of, but I'm sure it's more than that. At least 22 I know of. Elements that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, we wouldn't be here. Okay? That says something to me. I love teaching organic chemistry. Carbon's my favorite example. Because I spend the first two classes when I teach organic listing all the properties that are unique to carbon. And each of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, we wouldn't be here. Then I just kind of stop and I smile because my students figure out I'm a Christian pretty quickly, I'm the Christian professor on campus, by the way, I'm the sponsor for the R Club, but I'm also the sponsor for some other Christian clubs. That's interesting. I've even gone out and shared my faith with some of these other clubs a couple times. But anyway, some of the properties that carbon has is that if carbon forms four bonds, are you going, wow, that's really great. That's so interesting. All right. But it turns out, unless an atom has four bonds, the molecules it forms are not three-dimensional. And if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, then you don't have three-dimensional life, which is problematic. It turns out, it's not actually true. I exaggerated a little bit. It turns out there are two elements that form four bonds, and that is carbon and silicon. And there's this Star Trek episode. Do we have any Star Trek fans out there? Yeah. And this episode is so bad they don't even show it on the reruns. But it's the one where there's this monster, and they're in this cave, and Spock is there. Oh, this tricorder. He says, silicon monster, very logical. And the reason they did that is because of the whole four bond thing. But the problem with that is, if you try to make a molecule with two silicon atoms attached, it explodes. Not very good. All right, so carbon has that property. And carbon has another property, which it's the only element that forms large molecules. Well, gee, if we can't form large molecules, I guess we can't have life. And there's a bunch of other things I could say about carbon. I tell my organic chemistry students, and all of which are essential, by the way, but I won't go there right now. All right, now, another element that has an important and unique property is iron. Okay, iron is this one right here.
And the thing that makes iron unique is that it forms a strong magnetic field. Iron is the only element that forms a strong magnetic field, which is absolutely essential, because otherwise how could you put your kids' homework on the refrigerator? Kate's laughing back there. She's heard that joke 27 times. Yeah. My daughter. Yeah. But anyway, that's not the reason. The reason is, see, now, I could talk about the design of the sun and the fact that, by the way, another unique element is hydrogen, because hydrogen is the only element which can fuse to create usable energy for life. All right, but then, you know, it's kind of hot there. In order to get enough energy to sustain life, things have to get kind of hot, you know? So you don't want to be there. But the cool thing is, the sun gives off mostly visible light. Almost all the energy that comes from the sun is in the form of visible light. And visible light is the only kind of light that can initiate chemical reactions without destroying things, lucky for us. But the sun gives off two kinds of energy that would destroy all life. And that's the ions, the cosmic wind, if you will, the solar wind, and then UV. As far as the solar wind, what happens is the magnetic field of the Earth, it is literally a force field, that bends those ions that would destroy life away from the Earth. I say, that's a pretty good design. I don't think I could have improved on that one. All right, let me see. I'm going to do two more. Oxygen's another one. It's funny because oxygen actually has two forms. And both forms are essential to life. There's O2 that's down here. Actually, oxygen is technically not necessary for life. It's only necessary for advanced life forms that, you know, have a high metabolism, like animals, for example. All right, but then there's another form of oxygen called ozone, which, by the way, is poisonous and dangerous. And luckily for us, there's none down here. Almost none, except because of pollution. But there's a lot of it up there. And what it does, it absorbs the other kind of poisonous radiation from the sun, which is UV. Pretty good design. Now, you probably think uranium is dangerous. And the reason you think it's dangerous is because it is. Because it's radioactive. Okay? Lucky for us. Because if uranium wasn't radioactive, we wouldn't be here. So, again, lucky for us. Now, the Earth is around 4.5 billion years old. At least science says that it is. And I think it's probably true. And it just so happens that uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Lucky for us. Because if uranium was not in this... And by the way, also lucky for us, uranium is very, very heavy. All right, and therefore, where's most of the uranium? Lucky for us. In the middle of the Earth. All right, but anyway, and the uranium gives off heat, which is why the Earth is not cold all the way to the middle. And if the Earth was cold all the way to the middle, we would have no atmosphere. That would be problematic. We also wouldn't have plate tectonics, which plate tectonics was this brilliant, amazing recycling scheme. Now, it's kind of a long-term recycling thing. It takes 100 million years or so, but what it does, it recycles the minerals that are required to sustain life on the surface from the center of the Earth, otherwise they'd get used up as well. Pretty awesome. And anyway, I could talk about other elements. By the way, I forgot to mention, let's go back to iron. This is a fun one. Now, iron is the only magnetic element, but also it just so happens, it's also the most stable element. All right, that's a nuclear physics thing. It's the most stable element, lucky for us, because guess what the Earth is made out of mostly? Iron. And if the only magnetic element was not also the most common element in the Earth, again, we wouldn't be here. So that's pretty cool. All right, so there's a little bit of design. Oh, how about this molecule here? Now, it's kind of geeky, but when I start thinking about DNA, it kind of gives me chills. It's so amazing. The design there. All right? And you probably know about the G, the C, the T, and the A. I'm not going to ask you to list them. It's okay. But those are the nucleotides that have a code. And here's the deal. Life is based on a code. Now, according to Dawkins and according to these other guys, this code came to existence by accident, by molecules bumping into each other randomly. Do they really believe that? I mean, can they say that with a straight face?
that this code sort of came into existence? Can randomness produce a code? In fact, unless life exists, can any information created be created by natural processes? The answer, by the way, is no. Not according to science, not according to the laws of nature that these scientists supposedly, anyway, know. And it's pretty amazing because what happens is the DNA creates the information to create proteins. That's the way it works. So you have three of the nucleotides, three letters makes one of the amino acids to build these proteins. And the proteins, of course, do all the work in a living thing. How much information are we talking about? Well, in the case of humans, around 3 billion base pairs. That's a lot of information. That's the amount of information in a medium-sized library. But that's not really a good model for the... Remember, talk about the cell phone analogy here. Let's get a little bit more specific about the cell phone analogy. The amount of information in the simplest life is about 100 million base pairs. Let's cut it in half. Let's go for 50 million. Oh, let's cut it in half again. Let's go for 25 million. Kind of like Gideon, you know. We don't need all those soldiers. All right. So let's say 25 million pieces of information. What's the probability of all this information coming together that could make a living thing? To use an analogy, it'd be like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land on the ground, you could read it. From beginning to end, it would tell a logical, readable story. How many times would you have to throw those 25 million letters in the air before that would happen? By the way, I think the technical definition in math of zero is 10 to the minus 50, and I'm telling you, we're way, 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 way past that. But some people actually believe that molecules just randomly bumping into each other created enough information for a living thing. 25 million pieces of information. Now, let me kind of add to that, because it turns out in living things, the only thing that makes proteins is DNA. But guess what the only thing that makes DNA is? Proteins. Now, you heard about the chicken and egg, right? I'm telling you, the chicken and egg, that's easily solvable compared to this one. Because here's what Dawkins and others believe. They believe that simultaneously, in the same place, in the same clump of accidental stuff, the protein that would have made the DNA, but didn't, existed in the same blob with the DNA that would have made the protein, but it didn't. Because they have to both be, the one that would make the other and the other would make the one, would have to simultaneously be created in the same place. All by accident. You know what? Do you struggle with your faith sometimes? I'm telling you, it takes a lot of faith to be an atheist. I don't know how they sustain this faith in the light of reality. All right. Preach it, bro. All right. Nature creates order. It does. Order is created naturally. I mean, look at those crystals. Those are some big crystals. But nature never creates information. There are no exceptions to that. And we're talking about a lot of information. More information than any cell phone, I'll tell you that. All right. All right. With biochemistry, I'm just getting started with all the other stuff that would have to happen. I talk about this in my class. Even Charles Darwin said, it is mere rubbish to think at this point of the origin of life. All right, that's an ironic statement coming from Charles Darwin. All right, now let's do a little physics here. Are you ready for some physics? Yeah! All right. Before the 1940s, physicists were unanimous in this one conclusion, which is the universe had existed forever. Now, why did they believe that? Did they believe that because the evidence pointed towards the universe existing forever? I'll tell you right now, that's not why they believe that. Because there's really two choices. Either the universe existed forever, or it was created. Now, what did the Bible say all along? It's created. Hebrews 11:3. By faith we understand that the things that are seen were not made from things that are seen, but they were made from things that are unseen. But physicists were pretty convinced of this. All right, and then I won't go into the details about the redshift and the expanding universe and all that kind of stuff. But then in the 1930s, Hubble and others discovered this, and the Gamow came up with the thing. And what they figured out is this thing called the Big Bang. All right? And it's not like scientists said, oh, cool, thank you very much. No, it was like a 20, 30-year process of fighting it, you know, like, I don't know the analogy, fighting it tooth and nail. But you know what scientists have finally concluded? That the universe began in a huge flash of light. It's like, let there be light, and there was light. Before that, there was nothing. There was nothing. No space, no time, no energy, no mass. Literally, time itself did not exist before the Big Bang. Say, thank you very much. Should have read the Bible. All right. Could have told you that. But then, as scientists began to work out the details of this, it quotes, Big Bang. By the way, the believers in the Big Bang were not the ones who came up with it. That was the enemy. That was Big Bang, you know. It's kind of like they said, oh, you Jesus people, you Christians. It was made up by the people who didn't like it. But anyway, now, would you agree that's a small number? I need to move the decimal down. I should move the zeros up there. But anyway, change that slide. All right, that's 59 zeros and a one. Now, what would you say if your friend won the big lotto? Say, awesome! But why are you gambling? I don't think it's a sin to buy a lottery ticket, by the way. I don't buy them. I figure if people want to pay voluntary taxes, I'll just let them pay. You know, it's okay with me. It's cool. But anyway. Now, what if your friend then won the super lotto the next week? And then he won it again the third week, and the fourth week, and the fifth week. He would be in jail, right? Because we all know that that is literally impossible, right? Well, that number represents the probability that the force of gravity would be correct. All right? Let me see here. I won't go to that slide yet. But it turns out, as cosmologists began to sort of try to understand this event, what they realized is, if the force of gravity had been bigger than it is by that fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. But if the force of gravity was smaller than it is by that fraction, then the universe would have never condensed to form galaxies and stars, and still we wouldn't be here. So if you were picking the force of gravity at random, what would be the probability of having the right force of gravity? All right, about that. So that's roughly the probability the atheist is right. All right? But actually, that's understating it, because that's assuming that, you know, that there's never mind, I'm not going to say that other thing. It's just too complicated. All right. Now, don't try to read this slide, but it turns out that as scientists began to sort of look more closely, they began to discover almost every parameter that defines how the universe works is like this. Maybe not to the extreme of the gravity force. So there's dozens of parameters, the nuclear weak force, the nuclear strong force, electromagnetic force, the amount of electric charge, and all these other things. And any one of these, you dig with them, just like some of them by 1%, some by 1/1,000,000 of 1%, some by 5%. If you change them just slightly, the whole thing falls apart and there's not going to be any universe and no life. I don't know, I see evidence of design here. How about you? For example, if you change the nuclear strong force, that's the one that holds the protons and neutrons together, change it a couple percent higher, no hydrogen, therefore, obviously, no stars and no life. A couple percent lower, all hydrogen, nothing else, also no life. We could talk about the nuclear weak force, and we could go on and on and on. You know what? I'm beginning to think that it is just plain irrational to believe that there is no God, and that indeed that God is not a creator of everything. And pantheism doesn't make any sense at all, that God is the universe. Well, then how do you explain that doesn't explain the universe. That doesn't explain anything. Okay. So these are some great quotes there. I'm talking about the right kind of galaxy and all these kind of things. There's some other stuff. All right, so I would finish out part A by saying, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, so that scientists are without excuse. So don't be intimidated by smart-looking bald people with glasses. Seriously, scientists have the least possible excuse. Kate, don't do that. Stop doing that. She's telling Dan what I'm about to say. So bad. You know, they grow up, but they still don't obey their parents. All right. She's going to be speaking today. I'm going to get some revenge. A little bit of revenge. All right. So I want to talk briefly. About science in the Bible. Now, the Bible is not a science book. So if you try to analyze the Bible as a science book, you're going to make some mistakes. That's just a mistake of thinking. And yet, I believe every single time the Bible addresses questions, where the Bible makes a clear statement, which it doesn't do very often, but every time the Bible makes a clear statement that reflects on science, it's accurate. And Genesis 1 is a good example of that. Dallas McCown, the famous atheist evolutionist, said, "Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably unsupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent." Well, Brian's going to talk a little bit about the historical reliability of the Bible this afternoon. But, you know, people say, oh yeah, the Bible's full of just a bunch of fables and stories and just the made-up things. And my response to that is, okay, do you have an example? Can you give me even one example of something in the Bible that is refuted by historical evidence? Can you give me a single one? You would think that people would say that with such confidence, they'd actually have an example. They don't. Saying the Bible is philosophically unsupportable, well, you know, the talk last night and the talk tonight, I'm going to talk about that. I mean, this atheist philosophy is superior to Christian philosophy? Seriously? Are you prepared to engage in an open debate and defend that? I don't agree with that at all. Just to share the typical thinking, I was going to a conference a few years ago, and this professor lady, it was a bunch of science professors, and she said, "Christianity, what a stupid religion. I don't know how anybody could believe in that." And she said, "Yeah, for example, did you know that in the Bible it says, if somebody's wearing cloth of two materials, capital punishment?" What kind of religion? Why would anybody be a Christian? But see, that's the typical attitude here. So I said to her, "Excuse me, but the Bible doesn't say that." She said, "Oh yes, it does. I saw it at a website." Okay. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was going to check out if something's true, I'd want to actually check out the actual thing rather than a sarcastic criticism of that thing. And I said, "You know what? People say the Bible is full of all kinds of science errors. But, you know, I've read it several times through. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about." And seriously, folks, I mean, I'm trained to think in a skeptical way. That's kind of what science is about, you know? And I haven't found that science error they're talking about. I haven't found one. Now, Galileo did say, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. All right, so we shouldn't necessarily read the Bible in every case as a source of scientific information. So it says, when it says that the sun moved across the sky, we all know the sun does not move across the sky, but that in fact the earth is spinning. So you have to be a little bit careful there and not insist that the earth doesn't move, and that's the problem Galileo was having there. But what I want to do is I want to just look at a few things that are in the Bible that seem to reflect what I'd say seems scientific wisdom. Now, here's the Papyrus Ebers. It is the compendium of all the great knowledge of the Egyptians in the area of medicine. And scholars would say probably of all the ancient cultures, the ones that had the most knowledge or advanced, you know, study, if you will, of medicine were the Chinese and the Egyptians. And I'm sure there's a few things in Papyrus Ebers that show some wisdom gained through experience. I'm sure there is. The Papyrus Ebers was produced roughly 1500 B.C., which is, I think, relevant given that we're going to be quoting from this guy Moses or things that he wrote or that came by God through him. So let's look at some of the prescriptions of Papyrus Ebers. All right, to prevent hair from turning gray. John, it's going. Prevent hair from turning gray. All right, anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Good advice. Okay. And then a mixture of six fats, mainly those of the horse, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cat, the snake, and the ibex, to prevent hair loss, which clearly I've not been using that stuff. All right, now, I don't know about you, but I think the men were doing that so they'd be more attractive to the women. Women, would you hang out with a guy who's got that stuff smeared on his head? I don't think so. Now, there's some other interesting prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood. Not sure which disease they were curing with lizard's blood. Swine's teeth. Just grind that up. And putrid meat. Moisture from pig's ear. And how about human excrement as medicine? Got an infection, smear some of that on there. Now, we're chuckling, but really that's not funny at all. That is tragic. Average lifespan, 20, maybe 25 years. Why? Because almost everybody died of some kind of infectious disease and they had no cure. It's a sad thing to contemplate, the medical state of medical science back then. And then there's this quote in Exodus, interesting one, Exodus 15:26. He says, if you will obey the commands I'm giving you today, you will not have the diseases of your neighbors. You know, think about this. How many cultures that were in existence, let's say 1500 BC or 1000 BC, are still around, have a continuous record of history and culture? The Chinese, for sure. I would say the Indian, the Hindu culture, Egyptian, and then the Jewish ones. I mean, the Jews don't seem to fit into that category very well. But I believe this, that the Jews, when they were faithful to God and obeyed his laws, as we'll see, they lived longer, they had more children, they lived healthier lives, both emotionally and physically healthier lives. And it's interesting, because what we're going to see is in each one of these commands, first of all, God doesn't tell them why. He just says to do it. And second of all, each of these commands, amazingly, has a spiritual teaching behind it and a physical benefit, both simultaneously. And God can do that kind of stuff. He can tell a story. He can present a metaphor through an actual event that actually happened. God can do this stuff. God is pretty amazing. So Leviticus 11, I'm sure you're familiar. There are many kinds of meat that you can and can't eat according to Judaism. And it just so happens if you break it down, if you ask which meats did God say they could eat and which did he say they could not eat, and you ask which meats carry many, many diseases or are very dangerous to eat, there's pretty much close to a one-to-one correspondence between health and the meat he said they could eat. Yeah. All right, for example, beef, yes, pork, no. Now, pork is known to carry at least 22 diseases, including trichinosis. Not all of them deadly, but many of them deadly. Even raw beef is relatively safe. Now, I'm not suggesting that you make a habit of eating raw beef, but I was eating in a restaurant in Venezuela a few years ago, and you know I speak Spanish, but I didn't know what it was. I said, just bring me some of that, and it was a plate of raw beef, and I thought back to Leviticus 11. I said, yeah, go for it. Okay, the Bible is quite specific. Carnivores of all sorts are out. And carnivores, highest up the food chain, are very dangerous. And yet, the Egyptians, the Sumerians, all these other people were eating all these things. It says, fish with scales, yes. Seafood, no. And again, seafood carries all kinds of diseases. And yet, fish, raw, even raw, sushi, fish is relatively safe. Now, if this was the only example from the Old Testament, we could say, all right, that's interesting. But how did Moses know this? And again, remember, that friend, we're talking about that friend in the car, is like, you know, how could anybody believe this religion with this, all this stupid stuff in it that's obviously unscientific? I say, okay, can you explain this one? How do you explain the fact that all ancient peoples ate all these foods, the only ones who did not is the Jews, and in every case, or nearly every case, when we can scientifically kind of look at it, there seems to be a pretty much one-to-one correspondence here. And again, if this is the only example, we could leave it at that. But you have to understand, if my friend, if she was right, then the Bible would have stuff in it like Papyrus Ebers. It would have to. Because if you think about it, the Bible has quite a bit of medical advice. It says, avoid eating all the fat. Well, there's some pretty good advice right there. And with all this medical advice, if it was the wisdom of human beings, then the kinds of things that are in Papyrus Ebers would have to enter in. Okay, so just to show that maybe it's not some kind of medical talent of the Jews, here are some quotes from a Jewish document, ancient document, giving some medical advice. I'll go for the second one. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Stop right there. According to this document, flies don't have poop. Now, is that true? No, surely they do. They have to, all right? They must. And I've never actually checked into it, but I'm pretty sure they do. All right? It's probably too small to see. Let's not think about that stuff. But anyway, it says, is a specific against the poison of the viper. So you get bitten by a snake. So I think they had to keep a jar of flies ready to go. Because once you get bitten by the viper, you got to catch them, put it on there. What do you think about that? I don't think so. Okay, this is a small example. But clearly, the point is, there's nothing like this in the Bible, period. Not a single one, not one. Okay, whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with water on the third and seventh day. Hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent furnishings and the people over there. So when you touch a dead body, first of all, you're unclean. That's kind of harsh. What we're saying is the people who prepare the body of the family members for the funeral can't attend the funeral, and they have to be sort of apart for 10 days. That's kind of cruel. Okay? Now let's consider an event that happened in the 1840s, I believe it is. It was in Vienna. A guy named Ignaz Semmelweis. Who gave him the name Ignaz? What kind of name is that? Ignaz Semmelweis. He was a doctor working in a hospital in Vienna, and it was a woman's hospital. The death rate in that hospital, by the way, I was giving this talk in Budapest, and I said he was Serbian, and they said, no, he's Hungarian. And then they took me to his house, which is there in Budapest, so I don't say that anymore. Anyway, there was an 18% death rate in this woman's hospital. The reason women did not have children in the hospital back then was not because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. The reason they didn't have it in the hospital is because they couldn't afford to. The reason they did have it in the hospital is because they couldn't afford to have the doctor come to their home. Because it was like a death trap. And what Semmelweis noticed is the doctors would examine the patients who died the day before down there in the morgue and kind of do their little science thing. Then they'd go up and examine the women. And we cringe at the thought. The Bible says if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. That seems wise to me. So he said, if you touch a dead body, you clean your hands very, very thoroughly with soap and water. And some of the things that he invented for doing that are still in his museum. That's kind of cool. But then the Bible also says when women give birth or have a period, they're unclean. Why did God say that? Because everybody knows that God hates women and so does the Bible. It's misogynistic, right? No, I don't think so. I think it's because God loves women. Because when a woman gives birth, she's very susceptible to infection. So what Semmelweis said is, not only after you touch a dead body, but even after you touch a live body of a woman in this hospital, you wash your hands with soap and water. And the death rate went down to less than 0.5% from 18%. All right? They should have had a marching parade and celebrated Semmelweis. They do today, but you know what happens. They celebrate him after they die. They fired him instead. And he died of an infection not too long afterward. All right? Now, doctors didn't know how to explain what was going on because this is before germ theory had been discovered. Now, does God say to wash your hands with soap and water to prevent germs? They would have said, germ, that's not one of the words in our vocabulary. He would have said, well, let me tell you what a germ is. It's a microscopic, what's a microscope? He just says, look, wash your hands with soap and water. Okay? By the way, hyssop is the herb that was used. Hyssop is an herb, kind of like thyme, you know, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. And it's very, very oily. And the oil of the hyssop mixes with the ash and the water to make soap. But hyssop is an unusual plant because 10% of oil of hyssop is this compound, the one behind me. All right? And I teach organic chemistry. And this, we call this a phenol, that functional group there. Anybody take organic chemistry? Yeah, all right, phenol. And one of the properties of phenols, it's kind of unique at that functional group. Generally, they're not poisonous to animals, but they kill bacteria. So God's formula, if you touch a dead body, is to wash yourself and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. That's interesting. How did Moses know about thymol? All right. As long as the infection remains unclean, he must live alone. He must live outside the camp. God prescribed quarantine for certain skin diseases. Again, if you got this disease, you had a sentence of exile for the rest of your life. Harsh and cruel. But then again, God says, if you obey my laws, you're not going to have any of these diseases. So let's talk about leprosy. Leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. It didn't kill the most people. Cholera killed more people. Malaria killed more people. There are many diseases that killed more people. But it was the most feared disease because of the way it killed people. It's horrendous what it does. They didn't know about bacteria. God said, exile, separation. You know, they had different theories. Some people said it was the alignment of the planets. Other people said it was eating hot food. Well, if eating hot food was the source, then there'd be no leprosy in India and Thailand. So that can't be it. All right? But God simply said, quarantine. Now, it turns out in Scandinavia, I believe it was the 1600s, there were some monks who said, let's try it. Actually, it was the 15th century. They said, let's try it. Let's try quarantine when people get leprosy. And within about three generations, leprosy had disappeared in Europe. Simply trying God's answer. Okay, two more examples. You get the idea. After all, you get the idea. Leviticus 17:14 says, the life of every creature is in the blood. Do not eat the blood because the life is in the blood. Now, I haven't stopped in each case, but notice for each of these, there's a spiritual teaching. Leprosy is kind of and being unclean is used as a spiritual analogy to sin. And here the blood, he says the life is in the blood. Spiritually, the life is in the blood. All right? Now, medical science says if you're sick, this back then. Medical science back then says if you're sick, the disease is in the blood. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science says the disease is in the blood, so they had bloodletting. And almost every disease, they go in there and let the blood, if you're still sick, they take some more out. And you've got some nice tools for bloodletting. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science said the disease is in the blood, which is logical, by the way. The disease is in the blood is logical because it could explain how the disease can pass around the body. But no, the cure is in the blood. And taking the blood out is the worst possible thing. Because where is our immune system housed if it's not in our blood? Last example. For generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Now, two parts here. By the way, this is pre-Moses. This goes back to Abraham. Two parts. First of all, circumcision. Second of all, 8th day. Why circumcision? Ouch, that hurts. And by the way, circumcision is not without danger. There is danger, I mean, you know, back then. Why circumcision? Well, think about it. What did most people die from back then? Infectious diseases, bacteria, yeast that live in warm, wet, dark places. And where's the warmest, wettest, darkest place on a guy? All right? I mean, seriously. And removing the foreskin had fantastically great advantages. And who was saved from death the most? The women were, of course. And there's been multiple studies showing that if men are circumcised, the spread of AIDS reduces by 60% or more, simply by circumcision. In fact, in Africa, they started massive circumcision programs. They're asking adult men to get circumcised. I think they should just kind of go back to this eighth-day circumcision. By the way, under modern conditions where men take showers and where they follow the Bible's advice to only have sex with one person for life, AIDS would disappear. It would simply disappear very quickly. So a circumcision is not necessary for Christians. We're not taught to do that. But why the eighth day? Why not the first day? All right, why not the third day, the number three, and the number seven or 12? You know, why the eighth day? Eight is nothing in particular to the Jews. But, you know, the Bible doesn't say why. And by the way, there's the spiritual meaning of circumcision and, you know, the baptism, and that's all really great. But it did have a medical advantage as well. Why the eighth day? Well, you can see vitamin K. It turns out vitamin K does not pass from mother to child through the placenta. It's a lipid-based thing, so it doesn't pass through the placenta. So a baby, when they're born, have no vitamin K. Now, actually, vitamin K is not what causes the blood to clot. It's the prothrombin, which is a protein which vitamin K helps to produce. So babies, when they're born, have a little bit of prothrombin, not much, a little bit. But then because they have no vitamin K, their prothrombin drops to zero. So circumcising a child the day they're born, first, second, third, fourth day, very bad idea. They'd probably bleed out. Okay? But what happens is, baby eats from mom, bacteria, the gut, your prothrombin comes from the bacteria in your gut, and what happens is the prothrombin level goes up to a higher than normal level, and then it backs down to the equilibrium level that the rest of us have. I'm going to show you a graph of prothrombin versus time from the point of birth, and from the day a baby is born till the day a baby dies, the safest day to have a circumcision would be the eighth day. Or the ninth day, that would be fine. Seventh day would be equally good. So I see some medical wisdom here. So those who say the Bible is, you know, a bunch of fables and fantasies and no scientist could ever believe in the Bible, because really the first part, all we showed was there's a creator. What did we learn about this creator? Very smart. And very powerful. But that doesn't prove the Bible. Well, actually, in some ways it does. Really. Genesis 1:1. But then when I start looking more closely, I see some medical wisdom in the Bible. And by the way, I don't believe the Bible is inspired by God because of the medical evidence or the scientific evidence. I mean, here is the reasons I'm convinced as that you're sitting there that the Bible is inspired by God from beginning to end. And the scientific evidence for that is like this little tiny fraction of all the evidence for that. But it's pretty powerful. And I say, if a scientist doesn't believe in God, there's two possibilities. Number one, like Genesis 1:20, it says they suppress the truth. Either that or they just never checked it out. All right, so we're going to take 10 minutes worth of questions, because we're hungry. All right, and what time do we start again?
2.
All right, so we actually have a fair amount of time. So maybe we could take 20 minutes worth of questions. So, any questions? Could be based on that, or could be from last night's talk, or, I don't know, how to make cinnamon buns, or whatever you want to ask. Oh, you weren't ready for questions. All right, well, let's wait a second. I'm sure they'll come. Got some great questions last night. Awesome questions. How about a softball question from that row back there? Get us started. All right. There we go. Yeah. Now, first of all, the average length of life back then was, it's hard to say. You have to kind of, anthropologists do this kind of stuff. My daughter's an anthropologist. I'll throw it out there. But anyway, they have to make estimates. But people did live to be 80 or 90 years old back then. They did. It was just fairly rare.
But anyway, yeah, the Bible describes people living quite a bit longer than that. And I'm gonna right up front say the reason I believe that is simple. It's because it says so in the Bible. So I'm going to try to provide a rational explanation of why people live longer. But I'm going to admit to you that there's no scientific basis for this. We don't have some, some body we dug up that you can figure out how it was, 847 years old. There's no scientific evidence for this. And one of the things that gets Christians in trouble is they tend to not separate the things they believe because of the evidence from the things they believe just because it says so in the Bible. For example, I believe in Adam and Eve because it says so in the Bible. The reason I believe in Adam and Eve is simple, because Jesus believed in Adam and Eve and it says so in the Bible. Now, I believe life was created by God because of the evidence. I believe Jesus was raised from the dead because of the evidence. I believe the Bible is accurate history because of the evidence. I believe the Bible is inspired by God because of the evidence. I believe in heaven because it says so in the Bible. And I believe that these people live longer because it says so in the Bible, okay? And that's the only reason I believe it. However, let me propose a possible explanation, which is that Adam and Eve were created and we have all kinds of mutations. The mutations happen. Many diseases we have because mutations. And I'd like to propose at least the possibility that Adam and Eve were more perfect genetically than we are. We are genetically actually programmed, if you will, to not live beyond a certain age. So I would propose at least, but I'm not saying this is a scientific explanation, okay? It's just a reasonable explanation based on my assumption that it's true. And I don't want to use circular reasoning here, but I believe it's possible that the first created human beings were genetically superior to us, and mutation happened that went through the population, and there you go. Okay? So I believe it, but I can't explain it scientifically. Next question. All right.
You mentioned eating pork in the Old Testament versus now. What's the difference? Is it because we know how to cook it now?
Yes, that's part of the difference. By the way, I strongly urge you, do not eat raw pork, period. However, we have conditions in our health system that allows pork to be much, much safer now than it was back then. Much safer. And they didn't refrigerate it, and there were just diseases. And by the way, Jesus declared all foods clean. That did not make all foods safe. He declared all foods clean. In other words, it is not a sin to eat any food. I was in the Philippines once, and they asked me, is it okay for a Christian to eat blood? And I said, I ate some for lunch, so I hope it is. But there's that thing in Acts 15 about that, and that was some advice, a temporary in that situation. But I believe that that it's not wise to eat pork that's even slightly underdone. I think it's relatively not wise. I don't do it. But that's not a spiritual matter. And I'm not planning on living forever anyway. So being totally paranoid about every possible thing that can make us sick, as a Christian, I just don't have time for that. But I still say probably some of the advice in the Old Testament is still good, even if it's not binding on us. All right, so I'd say, probably raw oysters is not a great idea. Probably keeping the amount of fat you're eating from the meat a limited amount, etc. But it's not a spiritual thing at all. And also, just like with the need for circumcision, I believe circumcision was a huge medical benefit back then. I believe that it has sufficient medical benefits today to warrant it. There's this anti-Christian thing to try to make them not even be able to... It's probably not here. You guys are more sane here. You're a little bit more crazy, but a little bit more sane here at the same time. All right. But in California, they're trying to make circumcision illegal. It's just an anti-Christian thing. But the problem with that is there's so many scientifically verified benefits
So, anyway, I kind of got off the subject. There was a question over here. Next, then come on over here for the next one, please. Thank you.
I was going to say, how can you explain Jonah and the big fish?
Ah, that's a great one.
Yeah.
Okay, there's a word that's used quite a bit in the Bible. It's called miracle. And I believe it's a miracle. I believe it's presented as a miracle. I cannot scientifically explain Jesus raising from the dead. I can't scientifically explain him walking on water. I can't scientifically explain Jonah being swallowed by the fish, but I believe he was. And there's several reasons I believe he was. One reason I believe he was is that the Bible is inspired by God. But another reason I believe he was is because the prefiguring of Jesus that's found in the whole situation is it's bizarre, crazy, and amazing. I mean, the fact that he offered his life willingly to save the Gentiles, that's pretty cool. The fact that they're gambling at his feet right as he's offering his life willingly to save the Gentiles. And the fact that, I believe, by the way, this is my own belief. I've never heard anybody else teach this. This is my opinion. All right. I believe he died in that fish. I believe he was raised from the dead on the third day in that fish. Now, I admit, I believe that at least partly because it works with the analogy there. But also, you know, it's a miracle either way. Whether God somehow kept him alive inside of that fish or raised him from the dead, it doesn't really matter. I don't know. All right? So, it's a miracle. And it's presented as a miracle. Now, by the way, there is that one story. Apparently, it's a whaling situation where somebody was literally swallowed by a whale. This was in some newspaper in Massachusetts back in the 1800s. This guy had literally been swallowed by a whale, and when they cut him open, the guy was still alive. But I'm guessing that was within, you know, an hour or two. I doubt it was 3 days later. Could it have been a natural event rather than a supernatural event? I'm not going to debate that. But I'd say it was a miracle. All right? Now, I heard somebody say that if the Bible said that Jonah swallowed the whale, I'd believe that too. Trying to show how much faith they have. But I would not believe that too. If it said Jonah swallowed the whale, I wouldn't believe it. But luckily it doesn't say that. And the Bible says nothing that requires me to ignore the obvious and to stop being a scientist and think rationally. All right? There you go. Next. Yeah, up here.
Yeah, going back to the long age topic.
Yeah.
You made me think of a question. In Genesis 6:3, it says that, then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. Now, would I be wrong to use that scripture as a possibility to explain the difference at that point of why the age got short.
Right, but I'm not sure what you'd be explaining. In other words, you wouldn't be explaining something scientific simply because we have no scientific evidence for longer lifespans. But so basically, the Bible's explaining itself here, is what it comes down to. Because the Bible clearly has these longer lifespans, and clearly we have shorter lifespans. So here the Bible essentially is explaining itself. All right? And so it's saying at that point, now, I mean, if you're going to buy, I gave you a sort of a rational attempted explanation of the change in lifespan, saying there could have been some genetic change. And then we could say that God's telling us this is when that genetic change happened. I don't know. But the fact is that human lifespan is about 120 years. So I'm not sure how to answer your question. It's just one of those interesting things. I'll leave it at that. All right, we'll take a couple more questions. All right. Oh, there we go. We're getting only questions from. We need some questions from some women. Cut that guy off. Ooh. Hopefully we can do that in BOA. We're family, right? We're family. It's cool. That's a joke. It's a joke, okay?
My question is about King Solomon. In the Bible say that he has 700 wife and 300 mistresses. And as you know that, you know this, when they give the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, God said that do not commit adultery. So with, why he did not keep the, you know, and then thereby other kings that have more than one wife. But 700 is very excessive.
I'll say.
300, 1,000. I mean, that 365 yeah. days in a year.
So should we discuss the details here and try to imagine what the schedule was or something?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How come he didn't keep the Ten Commandments? How come he didn't have eight?
I think one of the reasons he didn't keep the commandment was because he was a sinner. But actually, in Leviticus, it does say not to commit adultery. But in the Ten Commandments, it says don't covet your neighbor's wife, which goes beyond adultery. Basically, don't covet any of your neighbor's things. But, Technically, Solomon wasn't committing adultery. He was committing, polygamy, which is different from adultery. And it is interesting that polygamy is never specifically commanded not to do in either in the Old Testament or in the New Testament. Now, what we know is that God also allowed them to commit divorce. He allowed them divorce, but praise God for the New Testament. It tells us what we probably could have figured out anyway, that God doesn't like divorce. So God has allowed things that he doesn't like. God has allowed things he doesn't like as acceptance of our sinfulness, essentially, our sinful nature. And God allowed even polygamy. But interestingly, every single case of polygamy recorded in the Bible was a total, utter disaster. Abraham, that didn't work out so well. And it caused the family to be divided. David, didn't work out so well. Solomon, he lost his faith. So does the Bible teach against polygamy? Yeah! All over the place. Does it command that we not do polygamy? Actually, it does not. And I think it was a concession on God's part to the fact of polygamy. In other words, if somebody, for example, let's say a polygamous person were married. I'm sorry, well, obviously they're married. What if a polygamous person became a Christian? Would they have to give up all their wives? If so, which one? The first one or the last one? The Bible does not specifically say polygamy cannot be done. However, obviously, no multiple marriage would ever occur within a church. So God allowed certain kinds of sinful behavior, not because he wanted it. We know he didn't want it. God totally hates slavery, and yet he made allowance for it. He hated divorce. Jesus made that clear. He made allowance for it. And he certainly hates polygamy. Why? Because it's a terrible thing for everybody, for the wife and for the husband. But he allowed for it. And that's why.
Can I go now?
Sure. All right, we're back over there. All right.
obviously, I believe, like you mentioned, Jesus said, How do I reconcile that with the geological records about modern hominids and just evolutionary records of modern man and Homo sapiens and Homo erectus and Neanderthals and all the records?
Yeah, okay, good point. And unlike where scientists are saying, yeah, life was created by some accident, all kind of stuff, where I think that's just irrational, it doesn't fit with any of the laws of nature, I would say the proposal that we evolved from a common ancestor that would also include the great apes. I think that is not an irrational proposal or a stupid proposal. And I believe it is more or less consistent with the evidence we have from science. So we have to deal with that. So there's evidence of apes, which were nowhere near as intelligent as we were, which were walking on 2 feet, 2 legs, say 2 million or 3 million years ago. I think the evidence for that's pretty good. All right. Now, I believe that Adam and Eve were the first humans that were created. They were the first ones who had a soul, the first ones that were self-aware, the first ones that had free will, that were not merely animals. I believe Australopithecines were quite intelligent animals, but they were animals. And I believe the things that distinguish us from these animals are many and great, and science cannot explain that. And I believe the biblical explanation makes sense. Now, there's a couple ways of thinking about this. I don't know which is the correct answer. One possible way to explain this is, let's say, I don't know, 10,000, I don't know, when did Adam and Eve live? I have no idea how long they lived. I have no idea. 5,000 years, no, not 5,000, 10, 30, 100,000 years ago. I have no idea when they lived. I don't know. So one possibility is that was the first truly modern humans that had the abilities we have. Another possibility is God simply put his soul, spirit, image into an already intelligent, evolved being. And it went from there. I don't know which is the case. I tend towards Adam and Eve being a special creation. John the Baptist said God could make descendants of Abraham out of these stones, and I believe it. But that's a faith statement. It's not a scientific statement. So, there's the scientific data we have to acknowledge and not ignore, because that'd be foolish. But I would say what we know about human beings say that there's things that we are that certainly could not have evolved. And that is our consciousness, our irrationality, our morality, and all these other things, that our ability to create, our free will, these kinds of things. And I believe the biblical explanation is the correct one. Okay? All right, I guess he's picking, so here we go.
Hi. I wanted to know why would the Bible be true in comparison to other religious books such as the Quran or other books?
Because it is, and they're not. For example, we could talk about the Hindu scriptures, which describe the earth as in this cycle, this wheel of time, and several trillion years between each turn of that wheel. And it's simply not true. And the Hindu scripture, which says that we are God, that we are divine. Now, we could debate whether that's true, but one thing I know is they can't both be true. Does the Vedas and the Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita, do they have things like historical reliability? No. Do they have myths that are obviously not true? Yes. Do they have prophecies that came true? No. Do they have scientific believability? No. None of those things. And do they have fables? Yes. So, I mean, the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible, trying to put the Bible in the same camp with the Buddhist scriptures or the Hindu scriptures or the, the scriptures of Sikhism, there's no comparison. I say the Quran is in a slightly different category. All right, slightly different category. But if the Quran is true, then Jesus was not crucified, and Jesus is not God. All right, and so I would say that certainly, if the Quran is true, then the Bible is a bunch of baloney. And if the Bible is true, the Quran is a bunch of lies, and Muhammad was a liar. They can't both be true. So I got to decide, Jesus or Muhammad? I got to go with this. Jesus or Muhammad? Jesus, who lived a perfect life, the greatest life ever lived, the greatest compassion minister of all time, who fulfilled the prophecies, who walked on water, was raised from the dead, And Muhammad, who, forgive me for pointing it out, but basically had sex with very young children, had multiple wives, who was responsible for massacres, who went on raids, who had a very, very bad temper, I'm going to go with Jesus. But the Quran is an amazing book, by the way. It really is. It's got some surprising elements to it. All right, one more question because it's time for lunch. All right, our microphone person is choosing. Where is he? He's already picked the next one. Sorry, folks. We can do some questions maybe this afternoon, although I won't be up here. That's right. Tonight.
I wanted to clarify something from last night. And then
all right. Right, that doesn't explain all diseases, obviously, but yes.
That was going to be
there's genetic disease as well, obviously.
How would you justify things like that, or viruses which have to
know advantage of birds? All right, now, for example, genetic disease happen because mutations happen. And the reason mutations happen is because they happen naturally. And I would say in the big picture of life on the earth, mutations are very beneficial because without mutations, we have no evolution. And without evolution, we have no change. And as the environment changes, if life doesn't change, life goes away. So one of the, if you want to call it unfortunate consequences of mutations, which are absolutely essential, is that genetic diseases happen. God's issue is not with disease, it's with sin. God's issue is not with death, it's with sin. And the fact that genetic disease happens is tragic for us, but it's not an ethical or moral problem for God. So I don't see genetic disease as an argument against God being loving or powerful. Neither do I see bacterial diseases. Now, I don't have a rational explanation per se for viruses. I don't know of the essential nature of viruses, so I have to say I'm just going to trust God on that one. But I would say most disease is the result of natural processes which are essential and good. I'm not saying disease is good, I'm just saying disease is natural, and natural is good because God created it good, because everything God created is good, including bacteria, and including genetic mutation and evolution. By the way, a lot of Christians are defensive about evolution. Since God invented it, I think we just give him credit for it. And it's a beautiful and amazing system. It's a self-correcting system by which species can change over time to adapt to the situations which also change over time. And so since God invented it, we should stop acting as if it's from Satan. Satan's not smart enough to make evolution. He couldn't have invented it if he wanted. And even if he could have invented it, he couldn't have made it because he's not that smart or that powerful. So we're going to have lunch. And let's eat some food that was created through evolution. All right? Amen.